We get the hour underway by visiting with our friend Colin Fleming to talk about, well, a number of subjects as we often do, and remind you too, with a couple days left, Colin, the author of a book that would make the perfect Christmas gift, his new novel, Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Hello, Colin.
What is up, Rich? Don't call me Kringle Kimbo. How are you, sir?
I am, I'm officially on school vacation now, and so that's a good thing. I got to the winter break without getting the virus and without being quarantined, which puts me in a pretty distinct minority in my school.
You are officially holly jolly, then.
I am. And apparently quicker than the virus, but, it's that first step. That's the key.
Kimball, you need to open up your arms and embrace the virus. You'll be fine. Just go for a jog, take some Theraflu. A guy like you, paragon of fitness, you won't even know you have it.
Yeah, I'm an old guy, Colin. I know your looks are deceiving because of my appearance belies my ancient status, but I'm in that high risk group, so I'm gonna let it slip by if I can.
Dude, Dylan has like 15 years on you. He'd be out touring the country right now. He's old. Come on. What are you? 63? That's the new 41.
I'm not there yet. I'm 62, man. Come on. Don't age me.
Rounding up. Sorry.
Hey, let's start, man. I had so much fun listening to, at your recommendation, the Johnny Dollar series and this particular five-parter, the Nick Schoen matter. And I knew very little about Johnny Dollar. Was this the pattern that they did these daily 15-minute episodes that would last an entire week?
Only for 13 months.
Wow.
And the episodes, now the ones that are just a half hour long, they're really good too. But they hit upon some radio gold with this 13-month run where you would, every day during the week, the actual weekday, you'd get these 15-minute parts of a five-part episode. And they would linger over these human moments. I think there's just so much outstanding art tucked away in mid-century radio. And we think of mid-century radio now as like this antiquated, it's fun to look back in time type of thing. But it's really quite cutting edge. Like, if you don't listen to this normally and you go and listen to it, you'll be shocked how fresh it is, how immediate it is, how artful it is, how entertaining it is. So in the setup of the show is that Johnny Dollar, that's his real name in the show.
And his action-packed expense account, which I loved.
Yeah. So it's really a clever device, though, because he's an insurance investigator. So he's really good at his job, and he's sent around the country for inspection of these maybe false claims or that kind of thing. So somebody doesn't, the insurance company doesn't have to pay out $100,000 or whatever when it's like really dodgy. And so they use his voiceover narration, his expense account as the transition device. So it'd be like $5, took a cab here. And he expenses, it's pretty funny. He expenses everything. Like, he gets an aspirin, he's like 20 cents.
Oh, yeah.
Aspirin. and they make jokes about, like, oh, it's Johnny Dollar with his swindle sheet. But in this particular episode, Christmas episode, the Nick Schoen matter, and he ends up, there's this woman who sees a murder, probably, and she doesn't report, and she was affiliated with this gangster, and she flees to her home, her parents' home, in the snowbound Middle West, and Johnny Dollar eventually tracks her down out there.
I was impressed, too, with, the word I would use is how tight these episodes were, that the mixture of sound effects and music and the rapid-fire dialogue, man, it was just, there wasn't a wasted moment.
There's this scene where he hasn't located this girl yet, and he wants to find out what her involvement is. And he ends up meeting up with her father, and there's this, one of this gangster guys, they're pursuing her. And so they've set up this roadblock, and he's out there in the woods with the girl's father. And they're both, like, drinking a lot of Applejack. And it's just this very natural conversation where the father doesn't get to see his daughter that often. And if you're a father like that out there, you'll probably identify with how you just start sort of talking about this person you don't see that much, that you love so much. And he's just sort of confiding in Johnny Dollar. And it goes on. It's just so natural. Again, it's like being ported back into a real conversation in time. And then there's this one exception in this episode where he ends up in this cab, he's snowbound, and this young woman, she has a girl herself, and he is sort of looking over them. He's protecting them because he's found out what her involvement is. And he does this kind of faux entry in his expense account, his swindle sheet. And he says $1 million because he doesn't have a family or anything like that. And he's talking about how it makes him feel. And you're thinking, like, this is just supposed to be old-time radio. And it's like a part of the universe cracks open and reaches out to you. It's profound. It's brilliant, really.
And these were a little later. Am I right that this was around, what, 1956?
So, yes, this one is going to be in the days right up to Christmas 1955. So you get some spillover into 56 with these five-part episodes. But the actual show itself was on for a long time, and it lasts all the way into the early 1960s. Now, Bob Bailey, who's everybody's favorite version of Johnny Dollar, he doesn't contribute up until the show's end because it was an economic thing to save money. A lot of radio shows moved from Hollywood to New York City. He didn't want to make that move. So you had there were five or six Johnny Dollars altogether, the main one. And he was just, I don't know, like you find these shows and it's stunning to me. And people say, I read a comment like, well, it's just, it doesn't have to be great art or something. It was just like really entertaining. It's like, you listen to how this is written and how this is acted. Like when we've talked about Quiet Please, this is actual art. This was mainstream Americana. This was for Joe Blue Collar, and yet it's artful. It's every bit as artful as Orson Welles could be on the radio. I mean, it's shocking if you're not used to it.
No, I agree. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. We want to move to a terrific piece that came out a few days ago in the Jazz Times about Duke Ellington and his take on the Nutcracker. And as you point out, a lot of people, even Ellington aficionados, might not be familiar with this album. And I love the cover, Ellington, Strayhorn, Tchaikovsky.
Yes, it's a very colorful album cover. And it was playing at the, it's kind of how the piece starts. It was playing at my Starbucks, which you can't sit down in right now. So you can only go in there and order and take your coffee to go. So all the tables are cleared away and it's almost like a little dance floor. And I was there one night, it's already dark outside right now, and this was on and I didn't even realize that I was kind of like sashing to it because it's that hypnotic. And it was really a perfect blend, Tchaikovsky and Ellington, because normally a composer is going to be a rhythm person or a melody person. There aren't a lot of people that are both. Like, Paul McCartney is more of a melody person than he is a rhythm person. Count Basie is more of a rhythm than a melody person. Tchaikovsky was a font of melody. And also, if you think about it, you're writing ballets, you have to be pretty rhythmic. And Duke Ellington was perhaps the greatest American composer of, likewise, blending melody and rhythm. So it made a certain amount of sense that he could take to a ballet, and he could take to this particular ballet, and he could cast it in this sort of lived-in rhythm and blues encoded Harlem-esque crepuscular suite, which is exactly what he did.
And as you say, that both Ellington and Strayhorn applied the blues to Tchaikovsky.
There are a lot of blues notes in this, as a jazz musician would call them, and it's like there are these passages of rubato, and it's not the ethereal kind of shimmering, floating quality. A lot of times, like if you go to the Nutcracker, you see a production of it, the music sounds almost like descending snow. Like if descending snow could say something to you as it was coming down and be like, hello, I'm the Nutcracker, right? It would go along those lines. This is not like that. I think of it almost like mid-century and you are outside in Harlem and the cabs, the rhythm of the city, that sort of Piet Mondrian energy is coming off of the streets, and there are Christmas trees that you see in the apartment windows, and you're walking home, loaf of bread under your arm. It's a Nutcracker for something like that. For me, the North End here is like a rough approximation of that, but even just outside, it's a very urban, lived-in Nutcracker. It's almost like when we've talked about Holiday Affair, that Robert Mitchum film. It's a holiday film that people can relate to because the apartment, it looks like the apartment people live in. It's not like these palatial kind of homes you see in other Christmas films where everything just looks like a kind of Christmastide Camelot. And so this is, again, along those lines with this particular suite.
And you write that this is a very embraceable nutcracker. What do you mean by that?
Just that idea that it's a common man's nutcracker. I think, not to say that going to the ballet, I, as you know, I like the ballet a lot, and people sometimes think that's really strange. And I've read comments from people that they think the ballet is elitist. And I've never looked at the ballet that way, but you are going to, like, the opera house to watch people dance. And if all you know is, like, Netflix and football on Sunday, then sure, maybe that would be elitist to you because you'd feel threatened by that. But this is music that was on vinyl at the time. This was kind of late in Duke Ellington's career. And it's embraceable that way. It's very human, and it's not this sort of large-scale production. It's a nutcracker that you don't have on the jacket and the tie so much as maybe you throw on like a comfortable hoodie and have a hot cocoa and listen to it that way.
And you wrote something that I hadn't thought of before, but as I mulled it over, I said, yes, Colin is absolutely right on this, that you say Christmas is our holiday of the night.
Well, yes, Christmas is even more than Halloween, is the holiday of the night. And the piece makes that point because part of Halloween's appeal is centered on that spangled coloration of the season, of the days, all of that. You need the sun to help Halloween along. If you think about It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, Linus and Lucy are doing what they do. A lot of that film, the TV special, it takes place during the daytime because you want the colors of the trees and the gourds and the pumpkins and all of that. Whereas Christmas, it's a nighttime holiday. It is the time of the holiday of darkness and of ghost stories and the shortest day of the year and lights. And lights need, obviously, darkness to have their most sort of refulgent effect. And even more than Halloween, I think that's why ghost stories lend themselves more to, ironically, Christmas than they do to Halloween, because everything is shaded with the night. And I think Duke Ellington, who was a very smart man, intuited that. And that's partially why he gave this Nutcracker suite that crepuscular element to it.
You can read all about Duke Ellington's Nutcracker at jazztimes.com. Hey, let's pause for a moment here and listen to a little bit of The King.
Merry Christmas, baby. You sure did treat me nice.
Man, that is about as bluesy as Elvis Presley ever gets, Colin.
Yeah, I don't know, Mr. Kimball. It gets pretty bluesy. Reconsider, Baby, One Night. Actually, there's a whole compilation with the title Reconsider, Baby, that's some of his early blues songs. So he gets pretty bluesy, and even his early Christmas album from the late 1950s is bluesy as well. But yeah, he is in a very blue-shaded mood for that particular extended take, if you listen to the full thing, on the Charles Brown song from, different Charles Brown, from 1956. And everybody knows that version. They don't probably know the Elvis version. The 1956 version, listening to it before, it's almost like a jump blues, but with the jump taken out of it. And it's even slower than what we heard right there. But Elvis has that crack band. He has James Burden on guitar, is one of the best guitarists ever to play. And he really lays into it for like 7 minutes on the uncut version of that song, which is just classic blues, classic Christmas. I mean, Elvis is, I mean, in a way, I like it because he makes everything sound like he's humping the song, which is just kind of an interesting way to sing. But it's not like in some sort of salacious, kind of cheap, theatrical way either. It's like a guy on his own for Christmas, so I identify with it. And he's singing to himself as well, and it's just, you don't get much more blues-based euphonic than that.
No, and that Christmas album of Elvis's, which for many years was the best-selling Christmas album of all time, And there are so many great little gems on that album.
There are. And he had solid writers. And I actually listened to that full album today. And what's interesting about it as well is that Elvis is not like, okay, do this Kringle rubbish. He really throws himself into it. And the double entendres across the album, too, are, I find them pretty hilarious. It's like the things that Elvis got away, like Elvis in so many ways is like as putrid as you get. Like he's really, people think like blues songs are dirty and everything. Listen to some of the in-jokes in Elvis songs, and it's like, are you kidding me? I mean, I didn't pick up on it. I was like 14. But now I'm thinking like, wow, sir, you go awfully far, but this is some pretty great Christmas music. So he was always good, and he didn't, Phil Spector, we've talked about this, it said, look, you have no idea how good Elvis is. And he's one of those people, like Elvis, Thoreau, Orson Welles, that I become Louis Armstrong more enamored with the older I get. Like I see, the older I get, the further I go along, how much genius there really was there.
And Charles Brown is an interesting cat himself. Not only originated a Merry Christmas Baby, but another classic Christmas song, Please Come Home for Christmas.
He did. And he also, for Sam Cooke, he sort of wrote half of Bring It On Home to Me, which Sam Cooke is going to half-inch from Charles Brown and rewrite into something else, the way that Orson Welles might take a bit of Shakespeare and rewrite that and write it into something in his own voice. So he was an interesting figure, Charles Brown. That whole idea of having jump blues, but really cooling it down and implying the jump, rather than having like the jump be overt, is what makes that, well, really, any of his Christmas songs, they follow that same model of taking the jump out of the jump blues, but like it's almost like this ghost blues, because you're still aware of what the original idiom was before it was figured out in the studio, like in the camera, as a filmmaker would say. So Elvis, of course, was always a country guy, and he was a gospel guy, and he was a blues guy, and of course he amalgamated those three different styles, and you hear all of them really on this particular bluesy recording.
We'll wrap it up this afternoon with Colin and by visiting a poet that we've talked about before, and today you're going to actually read one of his pieces. Let's talk a little bit first about John Clare, a guy overlooked as so many were in their own time.
So in fact, the page I have up on the web right now, it's like kind of a Poetry for Dummies thing, and it puts it in John Clare's voice and says, I am a self-taught English poet who was overlooked for years. My poems have made me now more popular than ever. somebody's doing a little fake John Clare, doing a boat. But yes, he was. But also, I thought of John Clare, too, because his big sort of breakthrough moment, which was short-lived, was 200 years ago in 1820. And he was a peasant poet, and we talk so much recently about titles, and I put absolutely no stock in titles whatsoever or in formal education whatsoever. I mean, some of these people we're talking about, Dylan, Orson Welles, these are people who didn't graduate college. And John Clare was largely uneducated in the formal sense, and his college was nature. And most of his poems, or many of his poems, are about being out in nature. He's a very Thoreau-esque type writer that way. And later he wrote some metaphysical poems. But he also, for some reason, wrote a lot of Christmas verse. And he would bring nature to bear on the insides of homes in a really compelling way.
All right, and you're going to read December to us.
Yep, I got December here by our man, the self-taught John Clare. So, while snow the window panes be dim, the fire curls up a sunny charm. Where cream o'er the pitcher's rim, the flowering ale is set to warm. Mirth full of joy as summer bees sits there, its pleasures to impart. And children tween their parents' knees sing scraps of carols o'er by heart. And some to view the winter weathers climb up the window seat with glee, likening the snow to falling feathers in fancy infant ecstasy. Laughing with superstitious love o'er visions wild that youth supplies of people pulling geese above and keeping Christmas in the skies. As though the homestead trees were dressed in lieu of snow with dancing leaves. As though the sun-dried martin's nest, instead of icicles, hung the eaves. The children hail the happy day as if the snow were April's grass, and pleased as neath the warmth of May, sports o'er the water grows as glass.
Ah, that's wonderful. That. I love that. December by John Clare. Self-taught and overlooked. Colin, we thank you as always. Colin's book, it's out there now. Get it. It's not too late to get it for Christmas, just to get it for yourself. Meatheads Say the Realest Things, a satirical short novel of the last bro. Colin, you bring us a lot of joy every Tuesday when you visit with us. And of course, through your incredible work, my friend, we'll be thinking of you at Christmas time and look forward to talking with you again next Tuesday.
Okay. Happy Christmas to you all.
Thank you, Colin. Colin Fleming on Dan Tetha.